Now stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC 94.7 FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about law and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. And my guest this morning is Palma Pastilnik. Palma Pastilnik is a local attorney who often represents complainants, or as I think she would put it, victims.
Survivors.
There we go. In sexual assault cases, in the sexual misconduct board over at UVA, I often defend the boys accused, who I think Paula might refer to as perpetrators.
And respondents.
Oh, nice. So we're going to have a chat today basically about that process, about what the sexual misconduct process is over at UVA. And so thank you for being here, Palma.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Before we get started, let me just ask you to share a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of, you know, how you came to be doing this work.
Okay, so I have been at Central Virginia Legal Aid Society since May of 2008, and a good 90% of my caseload is representing survivors of domestic and sexual violence in the community, and more recently, a much larger chunk of that is with students at the university. I've always been available to students at the university, but in the wake of the Rolling Stone article, my profile became a little higher, shall we say.
Yes.
And
it's true.
Some alumni members of the community, when they read the article, thought that it would be very important for the complainants in these cases to be able to have representation, whether they were willing to call their parents or whether they had financial wherewithal or anything else, and said, okay, we need to do some fundraising so we can get legal representation for complainants, because the respondents always seem to have excellent lawyers like Andre. And so they did a GoFundMe, and in no time at all had raised tens of thousands of dollars. Mm-hmm. And then said, well, who should we talk to? And apparently everyone said, talk to Palma. And so we've been able to fund an assistant for me who is the services coordinator for the Sexual Assault Advocacy Fund, which is what the fund became called.
Mm-hmm.
And so Kelly now works for me in my office, and she's the constant point of contact for students. And so she can do outreach on grounds, and we're independent from the university, but we're much more available than we used to be.
Gotcha. And are you doing this kind of under the umbrella of legal aid?
Yes.
So
once legal aid is involved, the way federally funded legal aids work, and we are federally funded under the Legal Services Corporation, because we take a dollar of LSC money, and we take more than a dollar. It's not enough, but it's more than a dollar.
What's LSC?
Legal Services Corporation. Uh-huh. That's the federal funding for legal aids in the country. Then all work you do must fit their rubric, and mm-hmm. there are income restrictions, resource restrictions, and sorts of work you can and cannot do, and service area limitations.
Here's the way I understand it. Years ago, legal aids used to operate a little differently. They would sometimes take class action type cases, and somebody in the government got upset about this.
That's because our former governor's wife, who used to work for Central Virginia Legal Aid Society, won a big class action suit against the government.
Wait. And our former governor's wife, this is McDonald's wife?
No. Governor Kane's.
Oh, Governor Kane's wife won a class action suit against the government, and she won a class action suit against the government through legal aid. She was a legal aid attorney.
For Central Virginia Legal Aid Society.
I see.
But
so
in our Richmond
our
office.
Our local legal aid.
In our Richmond main office.
I see. So legal aid sued the government. They won. The government got ticked and said, hey, we fund legal
aid. No more
legal
class
aid.
Action lawsuits.
That's right. And so what happened here is that our legal aid kind of very intelligently and strategically split.
All over the country, a lot of legal aids split and reformed. And so we have Legal Aid Justice Center, which does not take any federal funding. So we have agreement between ourselves as to what cases they will take, because they can take any because
right.
they don't have the restrictions, and what cases we will take. And we have agreements on how we'll divide state and local funding because they don't get the federal funding. Uh-huh. So to make sure that there's a balance and that all the needs are served. Because in addition to not being able to do class action lawsuits, federally funded legal aids, like I said, have resource requirements. We are not allowed to represent undocumented persons except in cases of domestic or sexual violence. So okay. I don't have that limitation. My resource limitations are slightly higher because of domestic and sexual violence cases under VAWA.
What's
extensions,
VAWA?
The Violence Against Women Act, which isn't just against women.
Right.
And so that also increases the income and resources limits for people coming to legal aid with problems with domestic and sexual violence. Also, we're not allowed to represent incarcerated persons. We're not allowed to do any criminal representation. And we used to not be able to do fee-generating work, but now we can. That restriction got dropped a few years ago. And
what kind of fee-generating work would you do at legal aid?
Well, say in a landlord-tenant case.
Right.
The landlord has behaved badly, and so there's a potential countersuit mm-hmm. out there. Mm-hmm. And so you could ask for costs and fees.
Right.
If you could ask for costs and fees, we couldn't.
Oh, you couldn't do the that. Case. In
so
the past.
whether it was actually wanting to get legal mm-hmm, fees, mm-hmm. or if it was just a bargaining position,
right?
You know, because frankly, when you're in a civil legal suit, one of the things you have to consider is what's the cost to me,
right?
And if I don't have to potentially not only pay my lawyer but yours too, mm-hmm. that reduces the cost of going forward with litigation that maybe isn't quite as justified as it might be,
right? Sure.
So it definitely improves the position for our clients.
I understand. So just sort of broaden the kind of cases that you can take in your
and
in the legal aid organization that receives some federal funding.
Right.
The name of which is
Central Virginia Legal Aid Society.
As opposed to the Legal Aid Justice Center, which takes right. the class actions and things that the feds won't let you take.
Right.
Okay. So that's a long way of saying you're a legal aid attorney.
I'm a legal aid attorney.
And as part of your position with legal aid, you do these sexual misconduct cases at UVA.
Right.
What are the parameters of your position at legal aid? Do you do just domestic violence type things or?
At least 90% of what I do is that work. I'll do a partition suit because I did one. So that means I'm the expert. So now I do several. When they come, I do them. I have a pretty good relationship with the law firm that represents University of Virginia Hospital in their debt collector cases. Mm-hmm. So when the big ones that are in circuit court mm-hmm. come in, I'll do those because he and I have a good relationship and we can usually work it out.
So you'll represent the debtor mm-hmm. in those cases and sort of try to work something out.
Exactly.
Well, that makes sense. So the way that we ended up on this show today, I do a lot of representing. I'm a criminal defense attorney, and so I represent a lot of people charged with a lot of crimes, and I do represent a lot of people charged with sex crimes. And one of the things that has been happening is in the recent years, really, I've noticed it since the Rolling Stone article, but I think it was probably starting to happen before that. I've seen a lot of UVA sexual misconduct cases come through mm-hmm. my office. So in my usual shy and retiring way, I made a very reasonable post on Facebook about these cases. And, you know, my perspective on these cases is informed by the fact that I represent the accused. Mm-hmm. And I basically said, look, you know, here are all the reasons why this process that's being employed by UVA in these cases is not fair. Whereupon Palma came back and basically said, you're full of it in a really nice way.
I believe I used the word snarky, so that might not have been
nice.
I think
you did. You said I was snarky. And sometimes, you know what, Palma, sometimes I can be snarky. So I said, well, let's do it. Let's have this conversation. So here we are. And I guess, you know, what I haven't, you know, lots of times when I do an interview, I've drafted out questions that I'm going to ask somebody. And I haven't done that in this case because Palma, you and I know each other. And I feel like we both, you know, we've had conversations about this issue before. I remember talking to you once about it in one of the witness rooms at the Charlottesville General District Court and sort of, you know, giving you my soapbox rant on the UVA process. And it was an interesting conversation. And so perhaps we should try to share some of that this morning. I have printed out the post that I had made. And I had basically six six areas of procedure in the UVA process that I thought were problematic. Let me read them off first. I had titled these sort of sections: right to be silent, right to counsel, cross examination, presumption of innocence, jury of your peers, and standard of proof. Those are the issues that I took with the UVA process. But before we sort of get into that, I feel like maybe we ought to talk about what happens in that process. I mean, exactly how it starts and how it goes forward, because a lot of people may not know that. I didn't know until I got involved in these cases how it works. And the way I understand that it starts is after an incident, the person who feels that they have been sexually assaulted, which is more often than not the female, but not always, can go online, and there's a site where they report it, and the site is called Just Report It.
All right, well, so let me stop you right there.
Okay.
Because that's not always how it happens.
All right.
Because with the new state law making absolutely everybody at the university who's in any way employed by the university, except someone with a otherwise confidential relationship like a lawyer or a doctor,
mm-hmm.
is now a mandatory reporter.
And when did that statute come in?
That came in last July.
Okay, so July 2014 or July 2015.
July 2015.
Okay.
And so I will tell you what happened in one of my cases.
Okay.
Something happened to a young woman on a Saturday night, and she went home and told her friend about it, and it mm-hmm. was sufficiently horrific that she and her friend were very, very upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a rape, but it was mm-hmm. bad.
Right.
And they talked about it and slept on it, and the friend then went to have brunch at a dorm with one of her friends.
Mm-hmm.
And they were talking about it, and the RA walked by and overheard part of the conversation, and it was enough of it that a crucial bit of information that had to be reported had to be reported.
So the RA, just a fellow student at UVA who's sort of the person in charge of that dorm hall or
but
suites,
is an employee of the university and thus a mandatory reporter,
had to
report the incident.
What about peer advisors? Are peer advisors mandatory reporters? Unpaid peer advisors?
If they're not an employee, I don't know.
Okay.
But so Monday, this student is in my office consulting me to find out what her rights are, mm-hmm. what her obligations are, mm-hmm. how this might turn out if she mm-hmm. takes all her different paths, which is mm-hmm. the way we hope that people will come to us.
Right.
And she gets the Clery Act, which is a federal law, mm-hmm. required blast announcement about an assault that's taken place at or near the university. And she says, oh my gosh, he did it to someone else.
Tell everybody what that blast is. What you mean by that?
Okay.
That's an interesting feature of what's happening these days.
Right. And so this is now a federal requirement that's layered under or on top, depending on how you look at it, of this state law requirement to be a mandatory reporter. So the Clery Act is a federal law that requires, in looking out for the health and safety of students in university communities, the university, when it hears about any sort of incident of a sufficient level of violence or threat to the university community, to strip out identifying information, mm-hmm. but make a report to law enforcement and an announcement to the student body that this thing has happened and in the general vicinity of where it has happened, so students can be careful.
Basically, every student at UVA gets an email that says there's been a sexual assault on such
on
and
the
such
corner
a road
or near the dorm or whatever. Yeah.
Right. So just because I think this is one of those moments where I'm supposed to say it, you're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is Straight Talk. And my guest is Palma Pastilnik, who's a local attorney who represents survivors of sexual assault in UVA proceedings. So go ahead. So this Clery Act notice comes out. She thinks, oh my God, he's done it to
someone else. She did not recognize
it was her own Clery
assault.
Act notice because she hadn't reported it to anybody.
Exactly. So the ball can start rolling
without
the complainant being a complainant.
How often does that happen?
Actually, more often than you would think.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
because sometimes even if the complainant wants to say something, perhaps to get an accommodation for themselves, but they don't want to get him in trouble or some other thing, because there was perhaps police involvement or hospital involvement or something else, there's a record. So the because of what may have happened, the university has to look into it because of other federal requirements safety evaluations. Then they find out who the parties are. Then the investigation starts.
So
there are a lot of things that push, and they're all meant to be in the interest of safety. They're all instituted with the best of intentions. But as we all know, the road to hell is often paved with the best of intentions.
Right.
So a lot of times the train leaves the station with nobody particularly wanting it to go.
All right.
And then it's just a question of how do you best protect yourself and your interests once the train is going. And I do want to point out, I back up a little bit, that when this funding came up and we decided that we were going to make this structure in which university students could much more easily access me, there were conversations with the Dean of Students Office that one of these days there's going to be a respondent who can't afford to hire Andre or some of the other fine criminal defense attorneys in the Charlottesville area. And because of the potential criminal component and the other issues involved, they needed to have representation and advice available to them. Mm-hmm. And so I reached out to other members of the criminal defense bar and said, okay, I need you on notice and willing to step up. Will you take these cases either on a pro bono or a sliding scale, depending on the wherewithal of the respondent? And we do have a list. And so there are people available. Because my idea is that this should be done right. And your idea and my idea of what it right is different, but we both want it to
be done right.
Exactly.
That makes sense. I had no idea that they had any kind of structure in place for those folks to get an attorney. That's interesting. How would that come up? I mean, here's what I've seen happen in my cases, right? Usually the ones that I've had, there's a just report it notice that comes out, right? And the next thing that happens is my kid gets an email from somebody in the dean's office that says, come on up here and explain to us, you know, we need to talk to you, basically. Kid goes up there, and the dean, like a cop when he makes a traffic stop, says, do you know why I stopped you, right? Do you know why you're here, right? You know, and the kid says, no, or the kid says, Susie's mad at me, or the kid says, you know, whatever, right?
Whatever.
And then usually it's a boy, but it doesn't always have to be. But I'm going to say that because that's how most of my
cases
are played
out. We'll just agree that we're going to be sexist today. And,
right. mostly the guy will then say, you know, the dean will talk to him and they'll ask him a bunch of questions. And he does it in this sort of, you know, in loco parentis way where the kid feels like this is his school and they're looking out for him. This is his teacher. This is his, you know, in a counseling kind of way. And what's really happening is he's really being interrogated by the police. He just doesn't know it. So he makes whatever statements he makes, and then anything he says goes straight to the sexual misconduct board investigators. But he thinks he's been having a conversation with this person who's trying to help him.
Well, and I understand that, but he has also been given several different big and small information sessions about what the sexual misconduct policy is at the university, how it's conducted, and who's a mandatory reporter, and how these things happen.
Let's talk about those information sessions. What happens? When and where and what's the content?
There's a huge one at the start of every academic year, particularly for the incoming first years.
Right.
That lays everything out and explains everything and tells them all the process, all the violations, all of the things that are expected for you to do and not do as a member of the university community. And they're given the website that has all the definitions and everything else
the
as
procedure
well.
Procedure and the policies that you can find online.
Exactly.
If you get online and you search UVA sexual misconduct policy, you'll be able to find that site.
Absolutely. And you don't have to have the actual link. And there are several different parts of it. And some of it's pretty thick, but if you go to the website cold and you're an 18-year-old college kid, it could be a little challenging, but they don't go to it cold. I mean,
right. How many of these kids do you think actually ever read that policy?
Actually read the policy before they've been
right.
charged with anything? Probably very, very few.
But they get some information
They are given in-person information on several different
occasions. Okay, so there's a big meeting at the beginning of the year, and this is their first year, right?
And it's mandatory.
And it's a mandatory meeting, and somebody comes and they say, look, this is how we expect you to behave. Here's what our policy is. And they talk about affirmative consent.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about affirmative consent. Tell people what affirmative consent is.
Okay, so everybody clearly knows that affirmative consent is, you know, I said yes.
Mm-hmm.
But a lack of affirmative consent is also a problem. Mm-hmm. And so if someone is too drunk or too high mm-hmm. or too otherwise out cold mm-hmm. to be able to say mm-hmm. yes, then they have not said yes. Mm-hmm. They have not given affirmative consent. Sometimes they are incapable of giving affirmative consent. Mm-hmm. And so you should not. Mm-hmm. And one of the pieces of this that is drilled into everybody's head is – first of all, if you're also drunk or high, that's not an excuse.
Right.
And if both of you are drunk or high, maybe you should save it for another day because this could come back.
Right.
And so in addition to affirmative consent being yes, affirmative consent is also involves being able to say yes.
Okay. So we have if you're incapacitated, you can't give affirmative consent.
Exactly.
But we also have this idea that it can't just be something that happens. You have to have a conversation about it where the person says yes.
Or if you know each other well enough that physical action could be understood to be consent, that if you know each other well enough that you don't need words to communicate clearly and well.
What if you don't know each other particularly well, but you're receiving this understanding from the behavior of the other person? I kissed you. You kissed me back.
It's probably a good idea to say, do you like this?
Right.
Is this good?
I know it's a good idea, but from the perspective of where is the line and,
right.
you know, can you get your butt thrown out of UVA? You can get your butt thrown out of UVA for not having –
actually gotten the
conversation.
Word. However, if you've got all of those circumstances and they're not in dispute and all you have is a lack of a verbal mm-hmm. yes, but you both agree that you both did this, you both did that, you both did the other thing, it's not going to come to
that.
But
of course nobody both agrees by the time we get to one of these hearings.
Exactly.
Right? By the time we get to the hearing, it's I didn't agree, right? And so there is the rub. There we have this, you know, his perspective and her perspective on what just happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so since she now says, I didn't agree, and he says, but she kissed me back, we still have, but you didn't ask. Therefore, you didn't get affirmative consent, don't we?
I haven't seen one of those.
Really? You haven't seen a case like that?
Where
the guy says, yes, she consented. We did this and that and the other, but we didn't have this conversation. And the girl says, no, I didn't.
Where there's no other factor?
No. Like what?
Like a lot of alcohol or a sustained unwanted attention I haven't had one where there isn't something else besides that.
The problem is always that the facts end up being in dispute, right?
Sure.
The girl says there was sustained unwanted attention, and the guy says she was into it.
Then that's where the fact that the sexual misconduct investigators, they're thorough.
They are very thorough. We
very
can agree
thorough.
On that.
And for better or for worse, Ute today, says the old woman with a college student child, they rarely communicate verbally. There's a trail.
Right.
There's a whole lot of text messaging and instant messaging and mm-hmm. Instagram mm-hmm. and Snapchat and Facebook and whatever the hell else those crazy kids are using.
Right.
And so there's a trail.
Right. That's true if there's been an extended relationship between the parties.
Well, sometimes even when there hasn't.
Sometimes, because you'll have a trail afterward.
Right. And so Yeah, I kept, there was sustained unwanted attention because I kept saying, get away from me, don't call me, don't talk to me, I don't want to see you again.
But those aren't the cases that I've seen. I haven't seen cases where the girl's going or the guy's going, stay away from me, don't talk to me, get away from me. I mean, I might have had one.
We've had one.
One. But I haven't. But mostly what I have, most of the cases that concern me in regards to this procedure are cases where somebody hooked up. Maybe they've hooked up before. And this time, for whatever reason, the next day, somebody says, I didn't consent to that. And then we have this sort of gray area of, you know, what actually happened. And so, but I want to get back to the procedure. We're, we have so many things we could talk. You and I could go on for hours here.
Yes, we could.
So first off, right to be silent. In a criminal case, you have a right to know you're being interrogated by the police, and you have to be informed that you don't have to answer their questions. At least when you're under arrest, right? And
right.
then there's sometimes if you have an attorney before something happens, then you have a Sixth Amendment right to counsel before arrest. But in any event, we're all familiar with Miranda. And that doesn't happen in these cases. What happens is the dean sets the kid down, and before the kid knows there's a problem, basically gets a statement from him. And that, you know, sort of bothers me. And then the other problem with that is lots of these cases, once you've got this UBA charge on you, right, there's also the potential for a criminal prosecution.
There is.
In the UBA process, the standard of proof is preponderance, which is very low. It's a 51%, basically, more likely than not.
A hair or a half.
Right. Yep. And in a criminal case, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
In a criminal case, you get to have an attorney, and the attorney gets to cross-examine the witnesses. In the UBA case, you can have an attorney, but I basically am allowed to sit there next to you with duct tape over my mouth. I can't say anything in the hearing.
Well, no, you have a pen in your hand, and so do I, because I have the same duct tape on my mouth. Mm-hmm. And so you are allowed to propound questions. Unfortunately, sometimes the hearing chair is not always as good at asking them the way in which you would want them to be because of the way the process used to be. And so a lot of why the process is where it is now is where it used to be.
Well, let's talk about what the process is, all right?
Okay.
My understanding, here's what I have seen in the past, is I have seen, I've got a kid, I want to do a cross-examination, right? Girl says, this is what happened. Guy says, that's not what happened, right? I can't put guy on the stand because he's going to be criminally prosecuted, or at least that certainly could happen, and anything he says in this proceeding is going to be used against him later to try to put him in prison. So my advice to him is going to be shut your mouth.
Can be, and it would have to be gotten because the proceedings are confidential. And so the police would have to, first of all, somebody would have to
they just get a
tell the police
warrant.
And they'd have to get a warrant.
But
exactly.
They do.
But it's not just handed to the police. So
I think they're working pretty closely with the police. In fact, I think sometimes there are meetings where the UVA police and the Charlottesville or Albemarle police are both in the meeting. And I mean, these parties are working very closely together. While they may not get absolutely everything without asking, it's pretty easy for them to get, isn't it?
I think there has to be. There has to be paperwork.
How hard is it to get a search warrant for the UVA proceedings once you've instituted a charge?
That I don't know.
I have one right now. Let me tell you, it's not hard.
Okay.
It happens. So you get they get the warrant. So basically my advice is defense attorney is going to be shut up.
Right.
Don't say anything, which means you don't have he said, she said anymore. You just have she said.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, the way you test she said is cross-examination.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't get to do that, really. I get to write a question down on a piece of paper, and then the hearing chair, who's been trained in the preponderance standard and the affirmative consent and all that other stuff, gets to decide whether or not they want to ask it. And you're a trial attorney. You've done trials before. And you
Absolutely.
Understand that when you cross-examine somebody, it isn't here's a flat question on a piece of paper. You have to follow up with the question. You have to ask some additional questions depending on what the answer is. And there's no opportunity for that if the hearing chair even agrees to ask your question.
Well, and you can keep feeding more and more questions, and I have done that from my end of things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's awkward, I agree. But again, it goes back to the way it used to be when people were being shredded and in a criminal prosecution manner in something that's not a criminal prosecution. And it's not. It's about a property interest in an administrative setting for and against people who have agreed to submit themselves to this process by enrolling in the university.
Well, they've enrolled in UVA. I don't think they really understand what they're submitting themselves to. It's kind of like,
well, at this point, they should. It's certainly been in the news.
Well, yeah. you got a point there.
It's an administrative process.
But I'm looking at the, you know, you apply to college, you're signing a bazillion forms. I don't think most people really understand what this policy is all about and what's going to happen to them.
And some schools are doing it better and worse than others. From what I'm hearing from friends practicing across the country, UVA right now is actually doing it better than a lot of them.
We need to take a break right now, so we're gonna do that, and we will be right back. So we are back on the air with Straight Talk. This is Andre Hakes, and my guest today is Palma Pastilnik, who is a local attorney who represents survivors of sexual assault. At least that's the term she would use. I would use complainants. In sexual assault cases over at UVA. And I often defend them. And we were just talking about right to counsel, and we were talking about cross-examination. Here's my issue. I have many issues with the process, but to sort of get us back on the procedure track. So the kid gets interviewed by the dean, right, makes whatever statements he makes, which then go immediately to the sexual assault investigators. The sexual assault investigators then contact him and say, hey, you know, come talk to us. Tell us your side of the story. But it's really very – I mean, I've listened to these recordings of these meetings, and I've – read transcripts of them. I've never been so foolhardy as to actually put a client of mine through one of them. But sometimes I get the case after the fact. And it's a police interrogation. That's what it is. These are attorneys.
These are attorneys who are trained.
Trained, and they set the kid up. You know, oh, how's school? What year are you? Oh, that's great. What do you study? Right? And then they gradually sort of work over to, here's the text message you sent, you know, USOB, right? And that's, you know, and they sort of entrap them in the way that a good police officer would or a good police detective would, right? And they don't really know better when they go into those. And they don't have an attorney.
Before an investigation is opened, a letter goes to the complainant and the respondent, and they are told they do not have to participate.
Mm-hmm.
They are told that is their choice and that witnesses cannot be compelled to participate. The respondent does not have to participate. They do not have to speak to the investigative panel. They have the right to engage an advisor or an attorney. And so before they meet with the investigators, now I'm not sure about that initial dean interview.
Not the dean interview.
But certainly before they meet with the investigators, they are provided in writing the opportunity.
Some of them are smart and they hire an attorney and the attorney says, shut up. And some of them are, but that happens in criminal world too, right?
Exactly. And the university also for, other evidence and other witnesses also cannot compel. So they can ask mm-hmm. and they cannot compel. And there's now the respondent, I agree. There's the threat. Well, you know, if you don't participate, we could still find
and
you could be in trouble, but the other witnesses will not get in trouble if they don't participate.
Right.
So that's a voluntary thing. So there's no opportunity to compel somebody to produce voicemails, emails, texts, whatever.
Right. But of course, most of the time they do. And that's not necessarily a problem. I mean, that's not an issue that I have is that, you know, the students give the evidence. That's not really the issue. The issue is more of a procedural issue. But the investigators who are doing this are not neutral. They are not treating the alleged victim in the way that they are treating the respondent.
Oh, yes, they are.
Oh, no, they are not. I have listened to the interviews. I have watched them. With the girl, it is all, you know, oh, and then this happened. And then did this happen? And suggestions are made for, you know, what might have happened. And it's a very kid glove treatment. And when they get the guy, it is not. I mean, I've listened to it. That is just not true.
And I have too. And some cases are different than others. And of course, you also told me this morning that you have not been involved in any case where there was a finding of not responsible.
Right.
And those do exist. So those have happened.
Well, maybe.
So,
but the interview process, the process of, you know, we're going to investigate this, it's very like a police process, right? I mean, the police don't treat the victim in a criminal investigation the way that they treat the person they think is a suspect.
Exactly.
And that's what happens.
But they do still test the evidence thoroughly, and they test the testimony.
Well, the way that they question the kid is designed to elicit the most damning response possible, just like a police investigation. Right. And so I'm not sure if I would call that testing, but okay. So that's what happens. And then the next thing that happens is they write a draft report. And the draft report gets filed, and the kid has 5 days to respond to it, right? To say
– both sides do.
Yeah, that's right. Both kids have 5 days to respond to it. The victim can say, oh, I want you to do this and this and this other thing.
I don't think you talk to this person or that person.
Right.
And the respondent can as well.
The defendant can do the same. But basically the report is a summary of what has been said, which will always, if the kid is smart enough to have hired an attorney, be she said, but not he said.
But there will be his friends said and the evidence says. So because often the respondent has many friends who are eager to come forward and defend him.
I'm sure they do. But as to what happened in that room.
Right.
Where there is often
nobody
else. She said, there's only the two of them. All you're going to get is she said. And then the report comes out, the draft report. But the draft report doesn't have any conclusions in it, right?
Exactly.
It's just... Here's a summary of what everybody says. And it's usually very thick. I mean, they do a very, very thorough job.
They
talk to a lot of people. They go to the scene. They take pictures. They get all the electronic trail information, text messages, Facebook, Instagram, all that good stuff.
In this draft report, they present everything that they plan on mixing together to come up with whatever finding
that's right.
they make.
And then after 5 days, unless there's some further investigation requested and something else happens, the final report is issued. And the final report has the conclusions in it and says
correct.
You're responsible or you're not responsible. But basically, you're found guilty or not guilty by the cops in this process. The investigators who have now set you up and done this interview with you, which is really like a police interrogation, have now determined that you are guilty.
Well, and I would say that trained investigators who have investigated thoroughly on both sides of the allegations and evaluated all of the evidence have made a recommended finding that either the respondent or the complainant can accept or say, no, I want the appeals panel to hear it because I think either this was done wrong or this was not properly weighted or this was not evaluated appropriately.
Right.
So the finding is a recommendation and it's not final.
Well, it is not a recommendation. It is a finding. You are found to have been responsible. It's not, hey, we recommend the panel find you responsible. It's we find you responsible. You are responsible. And then you have the right to appeal it. So it would be sort of like if at a criminal trial, the police got to convict you. And then you got an appeal right.
And I view it as slightly different, but it's also because I deal in both, well, not both, all I deal in administrative processes, not only at the university, but also, say, with Child Protective Services and whatnot. I also deal in civil matters like protective orders and stuff in court, and I don't deal in criminal matters except as to the extent that, for example, if a client of mine has a protective order, if that protective order is violated, that's a criminal act, and mm-hmm. I'll be there for the criminal proceeding because part of what happens after that is
how does that inform the question?
But what I'm saying is... I see all different things, and so to me this seems like a very normal administrative proceeding. It doesn't seem unusual to me, and the preponderance standard is common. Heck, even when you're talking about permanent termination of parental rights mm-hmm. to a child,
mm-hmm.
which is much more draconian than, no, you can't go to school here anymore.
Right. Sure.
Even that is only clear and convincing evidence.
Sure, but even in
So that's in a civil court of law. That's not simply an administrative proceeding about a university's internal, how they view and how the federal government tells them they must view and protect their student body.
In a civil court of law, let's say you're litigating whether or not your rent was late.
Preponderance. Right?
Preponderance of the evidence standard, I agree. But you get to cross-examine witnesses.
Well, if you are being evicted from your home, if your car is being repossessed, if your other property rights are being threatened in that way, the evidentiary standard is a preponderance of the evidence, and you are not entitled to court-appointed counsel.
You might not be entitled to court-appointed counsel.
You can, if you have the wherewithal and you believe it's important enough, you can go hire an attorney.
And then that attorney gets to cross-examine the witnesses against you
in a court of law,
and
not an administrative proceeding.
Then also gets to argue on your behalf, gets to speak at the hearing to the person who's making the decision and say, hey, this is what you should consider in making this
and
decision.
And in this process, the attorneys can write questions that the chair evaluates to make sure they're not too snarky. And then asks.
You can write
follow-up questions, and you can write the closing statement that the respondent or the complainant reads to the panel.
And so, then your client reads the words that you wrote.
Well, ideally, you have them help you, so there's
very
some passion
powerful.
There.
Let me tell you how effective that is. I just think it's amazing that we don't, you know, we're talking about essentially branding these kids, right? When this happens to you, you get a notation on your transcript, right? And the notation says you've been expelled, you've been suspended, or you've withdrawn while one of these things was pending, if that is indeed what happens. And so you get this, which is going to follow you anywhere you go. And yet you're not entitled to cross-examine anybody. You're not entitled to have your attorney make an argument for why they shouldn't do that.
You're not entitled to cross-examine someone the way you would like to. You are entitled to confront the evidence against you.
And it's not cross-examination to write down a question on a piece of paper for somebody who then decides whether or not they're going to ask the question, who is already on the girl's side to begin with.
Not necessarily. A, and B, we are going to have to agree to disagree on whether or not what the entitlement to confronting the evidence against you in an administrative proceeding is. And to my mind, this process allows you to confront the evidence against you. It's not the way you would like to do it. It's mm-hmm. not the way I would like to do it. I can tell you that on one of my cases that fell in several different parts of it fell in between several different procedural changes in the way the university handled things.
Right.
So it became very challenging to get to everything, and it went up and it came down and it went up and it came down. And at the end, there needed to be some very, very serious poking of this person who, yes, ultimately the finding was sustained, but the sanction was not the same at the end as it should have been.
All right, I'm confused. Tell me again.
This was just a complicated, and it'll never be like this again. It was a
this
one-off.
This is because there was a case that happened kind of in between the different policies and procedures at UVA. Because they changed. There have been three of them
in the last year and a half.
Right.
Yeah. And so this was a singular case, but yeah, I would really have loved to have grilled the heck out of this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would have benefited the safety of women everywhere mm-hmm. if this guy had the heck grilled out of him.
Right.
But that's not the process that we're dealing with.
But the panel does that. I mean, in my experience in these hearings, the panel...
Well, and now there's a panel, and in this particular case, that's not where we were anymore.
And the panel is not a jury of your peers. The panel is a group of specially trained people in the UVA
faculty and staff, yeah.
Right? So there's no students.
No, and frankly, I think for both the complainant and the respondent, that's better now.
And how are these people trained? Tell me what training they receive at UVA that qualifies them to be on that panel and why any faculty or staff person shouldn't be on that panel.
Well, I think I don't know exactly. I know that there are several different things. I don't have the names of them handy, but
sure.
there are several different sources for the materials for the training, and it's fairly intensive, and most of the deans of students are trained in this mm-hmm. and a number of other faculty members and staff members across the university are trained. I've seen a number of different folks in
but what's
a
the
lot
training?
Of these different it's about the policies, it's about the procedures, it's about the definitions, it's about how these things break out, it's about how trauma can inform memory issues. It's about, you know, how these kids are today.
Tell me about what you mean when you say it's about trauma, how trauma can inform memory issues.
Trauma can cause all kinds of really, for lack of a more polite term, wacky things to happen with your memory, just in sort of self-defense.
Right.
So that both your reactions to things aren't what Joe Smith on the sidewalk would think are the logical reaction. Mm-hmm. Well, if you were raped, why aren't you going to the police immediately? Well,
right.
Because first of all, if Joe down the hall, who you know is the one who raped you, you're like, he's my friend. He's part of my community of trust. That couldn't
right.
possibly have happened.
Right,
that
right.
didn't really. No, he didn't do that. No,
right.
he would never do that to me.
Right.
So you've got that process that, you know, somebody who doesn't live in this world that we live in would think, well, no, why would anybody ever? He did this horrible thing to her.
Right. Why didn't she report it immediately?
Yeah.
And so the training is part of that training is
to understand these sorts
why,
of things.
Why, in a case in which this might have happened, somebody might not have gone immediately.
Right. And why their timeline may be screwed up in their head and why, you know, they may not have specific A, then B, then C, then D. Memories.
Why they
and
might
also,
not testify in a manner
in
that
a linear
was...
or coherent fashion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also they are, I believe they're given, and I'm not certain of this, but I believe they're also given training in how substances, drugs, and alcohol can affect
memory
and behavior and things like that as
sure.
well.
Sure. I got you. So basically they're taught if a victim of sexual assault says, you know, I say didn't report it for a week or 2 weeks or a month or something. Here are some reasons why that might be, aside from they made it up.
Absolutely.
Right. And they're taught if that person says X happened, but then later they say Y happened, it could be a matter of memory issues, the trauma changing the way that they process or remember information rather than them not telling the truth about what happened.
Exactly. But it could also be them not telling the truth. Mm-hmm. And they are, my understanding is they are trained in ways to try and discern that and get through that.
Who does that training?
I don't know the name of that person.
Okay.
It may be that, I don't want to say because I'm not certain.
Okay. Are they ever told, sometimes people change their mind? You have a regret situation, and
Absolutely.
Then you claim that you were raped. Is that part of that training?
I believe so.
I bet it's not.
I don't know.
Well, neither do I. All right, so we're listening to 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, and this is Straight Talk with Andre Hakes. And this morning my guest is Palma Pastilnik, who's an attorney who represents...
Complainants
in sexual assault cases. Yeah, see, we can't even talk about this in, like, you know, enough to say something on the air without, you know, it's like when you go into court and you're arguing with the prosecutor and the prosecutor keeps saying victim and, you know, the defense attorney keeps going complainant, accuser, right? You know, it's all very loaded. So tell me a little bit about how this whole process developed. It's my understanding there was a letter from the Office of Civil Rights at some point that said to the schools, UVA used to use a clear and convincing standard.
Yes.
And the letter said, you know,
you're
you have to start using preponderance. It was like a 25 or 30 page letter.
Yeah, it was the Dear Colleague letter that went out to every college and university in the country that takes any federal funding.
Right. So what did that letter say?
Among a gazillion other things, it said, you know, you have to protect your community. You have to look out for the rights of complainants and respondents. You have to make reasonable accommodations. You have to do this, that, and the other. And in adjudicating these matters in your administrative proceeding, you must use you must not use a clear and convincing standard. You must use a preponderance of the evidence standard mm-hmm. in evaluating the evidence to make your determinations.
Or what?
Or you risk losing your funding.
Right. So basically the OCR said to the colleges and universities, you change your rules and do it this way, or we're going to take your money.
Right. But, you know, that's not an unusual way that things happen. If you don't institute a 55 mile an hour speed limit within this population density and nothing more than a 65 in this population density and this much in, you know, whatever, we're going to take your highway funding. And
right.
if you don't have at least 180 days of public school, we're going to take your school funding.
Sure.
So there are certain guidelines.
But the subject matter is a little more exciting than 55 versus 65, isn't it? I mean,
well, it depends on whether or not somebody rear-ended you.
that's fair enough. I've seen people get pretty spun up about that kind of thing.
It's like any other rules of the road that somebody in the Fed says there should be consistency, which I think is reasonable.
Well, I don't think we're just talking about consistency. They didn't say we all need to come to an agreement as to what the standard should be. They said this is going to be the standard.
This is the standard.
And they picked a standard that would apply to you owe me $5. I mean, mm-hmm. not a standard that would apply to you're a rapist.
It's a standard that applies to a property interest in an administrative proceeding. It's not a liberty interest. It's not your child is being permanently declared not your kid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's not anything like that. It's whether or not you get to have this particular college's
imprimatur. Don't you think as
imprimatur.
A society in Virginia, we've sort of overreached on the civil versus criminal arena? I mean, we have civil commitment in Virginia now, right, where you're charged with a sex crime,
mm-hmm.
you go to prison, you serve your sentence, it's time to let you go, and then we have some evaluators who decide whether or not you're a danger, and you can be civilly committed for the rest of your life to a mental facility, which is basically just another prison, but you're not entitled to the due process protections that you would be in a criminal proceeding, and the reason is that we call it civil.
Well, and that's outside my sandbox. I'm familiar with the notions, but I don't play in that sandbox on any kind of basis. But that's an issue. But I also have, like we discussed earlier, I have the issue with a whole lot of these evaluators saying that people that you and I both know are perfectly mm-hmm. nutsy cuckoo and are predators. They're lovely. They're a perfectly lovely person. They're no danger to anybody.
Well, the same thing happens on the other side. You get people who have done something stupid, but who, you know, for whatever reason, the state decides that they're...
Right.
You know.
And there are a whole lot of different flavors to sexual misconduct, both in the act and in the intent and in the likelihood of doing it again. Sometimes it's substance abuse fueled. Sometimes it's anger fueled. Sometimes it's stupid fueled. Sometimes it's misunderstanding fueled. Sometimes it's psycho or sociopath. Sometimes it's mental illness of another flavor that just this happened to be part of their problem in this particular day. This circumstance arose because they've got a whole lot of other problems. And I see that in, you know, both parts of my practice, in the community and in the university. So you're trying to construct a structure that deals with just a vast pool of behavior, both in terms of what actually happened and in what might be driving it. And that's always going to be problematic.
I guess what I'm trying to say about the sexual predator commitment stuff is that labeling something civil or administrative doesn't solve the problem.
Well, and you're talking about an incarcerative situation, and in the university setting, we are, again, not talking about a liberty interest at all. Nobody's being locked up for the university end of things.
Right, except that what ends up happening is that then they get prosecuted, and whatever they've said in the UVA proceedings can be used against them
and
in the criminal
I find
proceedings,
that,
and then they're locked up.
I find that very, very rarely is a complainant in a university process at all interested in any criminal proceedings. You and I happen to have a couple that
I think I got a 50% about half of the ones that I've been involved with have a criminal charge brought as part of the case.
Very few of mine are in that situation.
As a defense attorney, when you see something like that, you know, you look at UVA, and UVA, you know, looks real important until you look at you might go to prison, and then, you know, then UVA looks like you just let it happen.
Yeah.
But anyway. All right. Well, you have been listening to Straight Talk on 94.7 WPBC. The progressive voice of Charlottesville. And now we are streaming at 947wpvc.org. If you would like to listen to the streaming, and there's also a podcast on Seville Podcast every week. Probably this one will be up by tomorrow evening. Usually they've been getting them up within about 24 hours. And my guest today has been Palma Pastelnik, who's a local attorney in the Charlottesville area who represents, complainants in sexual assault cases at UVA. And I often represent the accused, the defendants, respondents in those cases. It's been great having you. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on and talk to me about this.
Well, thank you. It's been a nice way to spend a nasally challenged Saturday morning.
Yeah, absolutely. when we both got colds, obviously. Okay, well, y'all have a great weekend, and we'll see you later.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hayes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August, engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.